A lifetime of training, practice, study, hard work. Through discipline, some achieve excellence, mastery, fulfillment, self-actualization. What can we learn from their beginnings, discoveries, motivations, and falls? How do they dust themselves off and resume their journey? During these interviews, stories, and conversations, we reveal their intrinsic drive. Three-time Olympic medalist Dee Dee Trotter has been a fierce competitor since the age of 10. She loved basketball and dreamed of playing for legendary coach Pat Summitt at the University of Tennessee. Her quickness on the court convinced her coaches to steer their star athlete into track and field. Thus began a tenuous and oftentimes inharmonious relationship between Dee Dee and these two sports, her heart firmly fixed on basketball. Reluctantly, she became the Georgia State indoor track champion, setting a state record in the 200-meter dash. She accepted a track scholarship at the University of Tennessee with the understanding that she would be able to do both sports. But it didn't work out that way, much to her disappointment. In the midst of this disillusionment, Dee Dee continued to improve on the track, winning numerous titles, including a gold medal at the World Track and Field Championships while on the 400-meter relay for Team USA. All the while, still having to be convinced, coaxed, and sometimes tricked into running. However, her successes continued, and she became the first female athlete to receive a professional contract while still in college. She traveled the world and competed internationally, pursuing her professional career. But during the fall, training for the 2008 Olympic trials, she suffered what should have been a career-ending injury. But through hours of grueling rehabilitation and the tireless dedication of her healthcare team, she solidified her spot on her second Olympic team in the Beijing Summer Games. Over the next 3 years, struggling to find her way back, losing races, confidence, money, and sponsors, she kept believing. In the year before the 2012 Olympics, she began to create a blueprint, a roadmap to chart her daily progress. Through this process, she created new neural associations, speaking over the pain, negativity, and loss of the previous 3 years. Dee Dee was named the glitter-faced warrior by the track fans at the 2012 London Olympics, winning bronze and gold medals in the 400-meter run and the 400-meter relays. Today, Dee Dee is showing no signs of slowing down. She is an international motivational speaker, master of mental performance training, and recent graduate of the Atlanta Art Institute with a degree as a baker and pastry chef, realizing another childhood dream of becoming a professional pastry chef. Her delicious creations can be found at her Taste the Gold Bakery, where greatness has a taste. It was my pleasure to host this inspirational and purposeful superstar on this episode of Intrinsic Drive. Dee Dee, thanks so much for coming to Intrinsic Drive. It's such an honor and a blessing to have you. Let's go to your genesis. Take us to the beginning of your journey. Was it as a young girl wanting to be a basketball player for Pat Summitt at Tennessee, or what were those original messages you were getting?
Oh, man. So when I was, I think to go literally to the beginning, I was always a very athletic kid, although I did not originally participate in any sports until I was like 10 years old. So at field day, you know, first grade, second grade, I was just like out there killing it. Like just a little maniac, you know.
I imagine.
Was so competitive. Like we would have like, there used to be recess at school. I don't know what happened to it.
I know.
There used to be recess. And yes. We'd go outside for, you know, 15, 20 minutes of recess. And we play these games, and sometimes it was organized games, sometimes it wasn't. But no matter the game, I was always like, let's go all in. Like, I'm going to beat you. I'm going to beat you. I'm going to beat you. And who used to play this game where you run around what I think were bars for disabled kids to play on.
Okay.
And we used to use those to jump over and chase each other. And the idea is to obviously catch up with the other person and and tag their wrist. And if you tag their wrist, the next person comes in line and then you just keep going until you get out. And yes. I used to dominate this game. I mean, everyone was like, oh man, I don't want to go against her. But there was a line on both sides and we just go all the whole time. And I'm just like, who's next? Next, next. Like, you know, and so I was really, I can literally reference back to like second grade. And I was really just a young maniac when it came to, you know, a competitive spirit and just really having an athleticism that I didn't even really comprehend at the time because I wasn't applying it to sports directly or organized sports, I should say, just really just playing around.
Right.
And
right.
It wasn't until I moved to Arizona, I mean, moved to Georgia.
Okay.
My mom and dad were both from Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
And when my mom and dad got divorced, we moved to Georgia.
Okay.
And that really is what kind of set the organized sports into motion for me here in Georgia and Atlanta, the Metro Atlanta area specifically. Organized sports is a really big deal.
Got it.
And
yes.
You organize youth sports is just, you know, it's just crazy. Everyone, every family, every kid is like, if you're not doing it, like, what is your kid doing? Basically.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was, you know, that's how I got involved. And the very first sport I ever played was basketball.
Okay.
And I met my best friend. Her name is Danielle Merritt. Danielle's dad introduced me to, he was the coach of our team. And the very first team I played for was a Georgia Tech. You know,
right.
The kids version.
All right.
And
very cool.
I had no idea what I was doing, but again, I was just pretty athletic and he taught me the game of basketball. I mean, he broke it down. He's an excellent coach. His son
Fantastic.
Was a college basketball player and set records at Shorter University. And he really kind of planted the seed that sparked into a whole lifetime of athleticism and athletics, basically.
Okay.
And Danielle and I are still best friends today. So it's just a long, many, many, many years later.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's a wonderful blessing. And so Uncle Johnny used to take me and Danielle and our little basketball team to the University of Tennessee every season to play in a youth tournament there.
Oh.
So we would play in Stokely on the practice courts for the Lady Vols. And obviously, that's how I became obsessed with
that was the early inspiration. I got it. That makes total sense. But they were always telling you how fast you were. I noticed that from the references. They say, look, I just wanted to be a basketball player. That's all I want. But they're seeing all these coaches and mentors are saying, hey, but you're so fast. So that was early on that was identified in you, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, literally from the time I walked onto the court with Uncle Johnny and Danielle, there was an instant, oh my gosh, you're so fast. And that's really one of the most threatening components of my basketball game is that I was just so fast defensively, offensively. Mm-hmm. I was really, really hard to match. And I was a skilled basketball player. He taught me to be a pretty decent ball player. And so because of how quick I was on the court, every team we ever played, every coach we ever ran into said, whoa, that girl is fast. She should run track. So
okay. That's where
I ignored all of those ridiculous comments.
That's right.
I thought that was crazy. I wanted nothing to do with outdoor sports. I was very adamant about playing basketball. I was in love with basketball to a level of, you know, loyalty.
Yes.
And I was like, nah, if I run track, I'll run in high school.
Okay.
And, you know, I just kept pushing it off. But then, you know, as you go on, as you get older, your middle school, you have your field day, you have your middle school teams, and, you know, you start to get involved in these things, even if it's on a micro level. And the more exposure that I had in basketball, the more people kept saying, you should run track. Cause I mean, when you see me on the court, it's like a bolt of lightning indoors. It's crazy.
That's right. That's right.
So, it looks really crazy on a basketball court because, you know, most basketball players in a high school arena aren't going to be as fast as I was. So it looks really,
it looks
like a lightning bolt was flashing.
Very
around.
Disproportionate, I would imagine. Really.
So With that being the case, I, true to my word, I did wait till to high school to get involved in track and field. Other than that, I ran a little bit of the team stuff at the middle school level and things like that, but I just wasn't interested in running track. I waited till high school. Didn't run until I was 15.
Until you're 15?
And
wow. So you're like a sophomore maybe in high school when you
No, began? I was a freshman.
You're freshman.
I was freshman. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Freshman year.
My birthday's in December. So that's why I'm always on I'm always on the back end. I didn't start earlier. Yeah. So I was freshman in high school and I said, true to my word, I said, I'll run when I get to high school. And that's what I did. Yeah. And I did start the youth track scene because I met a couple of friends who were running what we call summer track. And I don't know if there's an official title for that. We call it, I think they call it AAU.
Right.
Track and field. And
yeah, junior really Olympics never, and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I was really never into that world. And so a lot of it kind of just went right over my head. I was just participating and not really getting in on the,
right.
You know, the skinny of it.
Yeah.
And I got involved with that, which introduced me to a couple of other to people I'm still best friends with today. But ultimately, I just didn't love it. I was in love with basketball and I just was, you know, like I said, I had a really dead set loyalty to it. And so I ran to be competitive and it made me a versatile athlete. I was at that point, I was doing three sports. I was doing cheer during football, track during track season, and basketball during basketball season. And I did the summer track 2 years and I was like, oh no, this is not my life. I do not like being outside from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m.
Right.
And so
it's just conditioning. At that point, it was just conditioning, but it wasn't where your heart was. I got it.
Oh, it was not conditioning. It was
not even conditioning. Got it. Okay. Even better.
Two of my best friends were running track and I couldn't spend time with them unless I was on the team. So I joined the team to do
Amazing.
It with them.
Amazing.
And then when the summer was over, they're actually a year older than me, both Vernica and Henrietta. They are a year older than me. So they went on to college and then basically that meant I didn't have to run summer track anymore. So I did not literally. So
okay.
As soon as they left, I was like,
you were out.
This is
I'm
over.
Out. I'm out. Yeah. That's great.
So I did it for the three seasons they were there. I did summer track those three go rounds. And then I stopped. And I went back to basketball. That was it. So I did run track and I did grow fond of it on some level. I was a state champion and indoor and outdoor state champion. And you know, I did well. I did well in track and field. It was just very natural for me.
And what year was that? It was sort of seeing an ascent here where you're coming up and you're rising in a new craft that you don't even want to be your craft, but what not yet. And what year, what was that, your junior year or your senior year when you won state for the first time in Georgia?
I was state champion in the 200.
Okay.
In 2001.
Okay. Okay.
And what year did I win the indoor title? I set the indoor in the 200. I set the indoor record, Georgia indoor record. And I won.
Awesome.
And that was also 2001.
Okay. Okay. So did you start to enjoy it a little more? Did you see it as a passion? Not quite yet. When was the turning point when you sort of felt like, okay, this is for me? Or was there ever one that just kind of came in when you sort of came into track? Was it by your senior year or when was that shift?
I was probably closer to 30 years old.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I literally saw it as when I was in high school and when I was in my early years of college, I saw track and field as a responsibility.
Got it.
And I also saw it as an obligation. Now, the obligations and the responsibilities have two sides. There's a spiritual side and then there's an actual side. So Excellent. The spiritual side was I felt that God had given me a gift and a talent that was undeniable. And being a preacher's kid and growing up in growing up in the church and just kind of mm-hmm. having this sense of moral, having a spiritual moral compass, I felt a very hard pull to make sure I honored God with the gift that he gave me, because I felt if he gave it to me, it was for a reason.
Yes.
And I didn't know what that would ever equate to. I didn't know what it would ever, you know, what the purpose of it was for me, but I knew that if it was this dominant and this something that I really didn't have, I didn't have to, it just was natural for me.
Yes.
So I felt the need and an obligation and responsibility to do something with it. So in my senior year, when I was really struggling emotionally and mentally to participate in track and field, I had to call on God. I literally had to have a conversation by myself with him on the track. I'll never forget the day I was sitting on the long jump pit, because I was also a long jumper. I was actually a 100, 200 long jumper is what I was recruited for. I never ran the 400.
Okay. Okay. So 1-2 in the long jump.
Yep. And when one day I was out at the track by myself, I had jumped the fence to go out and practice the long jump, because I really wasn't practicing very much at school with the long jump. Mm-hmm. So, and I wanted to do well at it. So I was having a rough day trying to get my mark, and by yourself, it's a little more difficult, especially when you don't know what you're doing.
Can't see.
I just have the minimal training.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Sure.
So I didn't grow up a track kid, so I definitely don't have a lot of, you know, background knowledge in that. So I'm just, you know, going with the basics, hit the board, jump, try to get as far as you can, you know?
Yeah, right.
And right. With this minimal, you know, ABC mentality, I was just trying to improve. And I was sitting out there frustrated, and I was like, oh, God, why did you give me this gift? And I'm just so frustrated.
Yeah.
And I said, but I made a promise to him that day that I don't know why you gave me this gift. I don't understand it, and I don't even like it, but I promise you, I will do it until I cannot do it anymore.
No.
And I made that promise when I was 18 years old.
18.
And, I kept that promise and that commitment all the way until the day I retired, because I wanted to retire about 2 years before I actually did. But that promise I set into motion that day, said I couldn't stop until I was actually done. I ran until I literally physically could not run anymore. And if you watch my last lap at Hayward Field, you'll see I literally almost had nothing. I had zero left in me.
Yeah.
So a lot of people will say, "Yo, do you miss running?" I say, "Oh no, I made sure that I wouldn't miss it. I made sure that I ran until there's literally nothing left to run in me." You know, when you're done, you're done. Yeah. And I was just glad I was able to go out on my feet and not some other way. So it wasn't until I was, to answer your question, it wasn't until I was probably 30, somewhere after 2008, when I was trying to come back from the knee surgery that I had, is when I felt the sense of love or having a deeper connection with the sport, other than this dislike that I, or not so much of a dislike, but just, it wasn't my passion. It wasn't until I was closer to my third Olympic team that I started to feel this connection with the sport. It took a very, very, very long time. And I hate that, because I always used to envy people who maybe didn't have the same amount of talent as me, but who had this tremendous love and passion for the sport. I'll never forget this girl named Kelly Flowers, and she ran for Tennessee, and she was a walk-on. Mm-hmm. And her talent was, you know, average for an athlete, track and field athlete, but she was the hardest worker, and her determination and love and passion for the sport, I was envious of it in a healthy way. And I used to just want to say, gosh, if I just had an ounce of the love that she has for this sport, imagine how great I could be.
Yeah.
And so I used to just hone in on other things to help me, to help balance out that lack of passion. I used to hold in on the competitive side. I used to find motivation in from people not believing in me or thinking I can't do it. And I used to, you know, create a sense of responsibility where you have to run because you have to get a college degree and you want to, you don't want to waste your time. Be as great as it, great in it as you can. And you made a promise to God. Like,
yes.
So I had all of these things that ultimately made me feel a sense of responsibility to the talent and the running.
Yeah,
and as long as I had those in place, I would never stop.
And you created these different reasons because of this responsibility from God and fulfilling your purpose. That was sort of driving you forward. And what were some of the other things that urged you forward? Any of the external or internal forces and motivations during that time? Was it mostly this responsibility, obviously, with your teammate, you know, not sort of having that as just for the sport, but you're having that for knowing your talent and wanting to fulfill this life purpose? Were there any other things that were coming up for you in that time?
Well, yeah. Initially, it was also about going to college and getting using college as a gateway to create a life for myself, because I never saw a professional track and field as a professional sport. And you got to keep in mind, in 2001, it was not as track and field for women as a professional sport was nowhere near as glamorous as it is today.
Nowhere near.
So, I mean, there's a whole era of women who were outstanding and exceptional athletes who just did not get the name credit, who didn't get the financial, reward that they should have received. Gerald Miles Clark was one of the greatest female athletes alive. And a lot of people don't even know her name.
That's right.
Outside of track and field. You know, if it wasn't Jackie Joyner Kersee, if it wasn't FloJo, and if it wasn't Marion Jones, they didn't know him.
It was very limited.
And it was like the great three, as if there weren't these other tremendously outstanding athletes, you know, doing world record level competitors.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there was no glamour in it for me. The only glamour point in it for me at that point would have been Marion Jones. And, you know, it wasn't very long before, during my time, she had, you know, quite let everyone down, quite frankly.
Absolutely.
So, I didn't have anyone to look up to there, but, or to even look towards to say, oh, track and field would be a great profession. I didn't even count it at all. It was not counted. I was like, I'm going to college to get a degree so I can get a normal job in America.
Yes. You know, I'm going to get an education. This is a gateway to get an education. I'm good at this. Let me stay the course. But then you end up being the first female athlete at University of Tennessee to turn professional.
I sure did.
Before finishing your eligibility, which was a real, is a milestone.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how was after that? I mean, that must have been really wild, saying, okay, this all of a sudden, this whole new opportunity opened up that you didn't even know existed through your craft. So you see you're kind of rising there in the craft at that point. It must have been a really amazingly exciting moment for you, even though you didn't love the actual training part but there was, you were really coming into a new awareness for what you could bring and what you could give to the world.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually set the boundaries for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I came into Tennessee, there's a fun story, but I'll keep it short because it can be a little bit long.
It's okay.
I received two letters from Tennessee.
Okay.
I received a letter in basketball and I received a letter from track.
Wow.
I was receiving letters from basketball and track and field from most every school in the country.
Yeah. So another tough decision you had to figure out. Am I going to follow God's purpose here for me, or am I going to go into what I want? So there you go.
I wish it was
the
that
crossroads.
It was a no brainer. I knew I was going to play basketball. But there was no question. I was never considering running track for college. It was not a consideration. Wow. If it was anything, it was a second option for if the coach at basketball lets me run, then fine.
Okay.
But so the thing is, I'm a very committed person. When I say I'm going to do something, I do it. At age 10, at 18, I said I was going to run, so I couldn't run anymore. And at age 10, I said I was going to the University of Tennessee. Wow. I went on one school visit. went to University of Tennessee. I don't care how many letters came. I got letters from LSU. I got letters from University of Florida. I got letters from Florida State. I got letters from Duke. I got letters from almost every school that was worth mentioning. And, it was exciting. Yeah, it was great. The biggest thing that hurt me in this situation is that I had no one to precede me. Mm-hmm. No one had done what I was doing in my high school. Yeah. Not a female athlete. The school that I went to was somewhat ignorant to the process. Mm-hmm. So they were getting the letters, handing them to me, and walking away.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I had no idea what to do with these letters. No one in my family had ever gone to college, a four-year college on athletics, or at four-year college for that matter. Yeah. And I had basically started two shoeboxes. I took the letters, I put the ones for track in one box and ones for basketball in another box.
There you go.
And then I waited. Mm-hmm. I waited because it's very ignorant. And I talked to parents and high schoolers about this now, because as much as I was lucky, when you hear the rest of the story, not everyone is so lucky.
That's right. Okay.
So I try to educate people now on the process and what they need to do so that they don't miss out on an opportunity like I almost did. So I took those letters, I put them in the box, and I waited, because my idea of what was supposed to happen next was I thought the coaches were going to call me. Right. I thought they were going to show up in the college, in the gym one day.
In the auditorium. Yeah. With fans. Yeah.
Just like they do on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Right.
Right. So, That's right.
I'm thinking this is the next step that, you know, mm-hmm. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, just like on the show, they're going to come in and they're going to watch me like they watch Will Smith. Mm-hmm. And so I am waiting. I'm waiting for the calls. I'm waiting for the knock at the door. I'm waiting for the appearance in the gym. No one comes. No one calls. Right.
Wow.
My basketball team is doing extraordinarily well this year. I was recruited top in the state. I received tip off club awards for basketball offensive player of the year 2 years in a row, defensive player of the year 2 years in a row. And I was the state has a team that they put together for international travel. I was always selected to be on those teams. I couldn't go to those teams because I couldn't afford the trips, but.
But you were selected. Yeah, it's a major honor. Yeah.
And with that being the process, I mean, with that being my accolades, I was a recognized basketball player in the state of Georgia. So as things became closer and closer to time to go to college, the letters coming and the I never reached out, basically. And when I didn't reach out, the question started to be, you know, what do we do? So my mom was like, well, you're still going to Tennessee, right? And I'm like, yeah, I'm absolutely going to Tennessee. So we applied to Tennessee academically. Okay. I was accepted academically. Me and my best friend, Danielle, true to our word, 10 years old, we're going to Tennessee.
That's fantastic.
We applied academically. We were accepted academically, and we went on the school visit like normal kids who don't play sports. Right?
No way. That's great. Yeah. That is so great. How refreshing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the whole mindset behind that was, you know, hey, we're getting there. No matter how we have to get there, we're going to get there. And I'll figure out the basketball thing when I get there. I'll even figure out the money thing as I do. We'll get it figured out one step at a time. Just keep going.
Right, right.
And then as my basketball team was having a killer year, we were undefeated at home, 13 straight wins. We were like just having one of those state championship years. We make it to state. We get fourth. We get put out in one of the worst games we've had all season to a team that we should have beat.
Yeah.
And we just had a rough night. Yeah.
Okay.
So we finished the tournament in fourth, and I get a call from my coach that night as we're driving home from the game. And he says, hey, I entered you in the Georgia Indoor 200. It's on Friday. And I'm like, what? It's literally like Wednesday night.
And oh, like, no. You're like tanked from all those ball games. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, coach, I haven't been training for track. And he's like, you'll be fine. It's just fun. Just go. And I'm like, yeah, I entered you already. So I already set up. Just go ahead and go. It starts at such and such. I'll send you the details. I was like, okay, all right. So we'll go. So I literally, straight off the court, right to the Georgia Indoor Invitational. I ran the 200. I broke the indoor record.
Oh,
and
wow.
The coach from the University of Tennessee was in the building.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Perfect. She comes running down the stairs in her orange jacket and her, she always wore a ponytail to the left side of her shoulder.
Oh.
And she comes running down the stairs with a little ponytail to the side and her Tennessee orange jacket. And she's like, "What school are you going to?" She doesn't introduce herself. She doesn't say, "Hey, I'm coach," or no introduction.
Right.
She rolls straight in, almost aggravated with me. "What school are you going to?" And I'm like, "Tennessee." She's like, "For basketball." Her face gets like a little sad. And she's like, "Oh, for basketball." And
the basketball.
And I was like, "Kinda." And she's like, "Well, tell me more." So at that point, I explained to her that, you know, my dream was to play basketball. I've enrolled in Tennessee. I'm accepted in Tennessee. I'm going to Tennessee. And my goal is to get on that basketball team. And she says, I think I can help you do that. And we negotiated a terms of agreement, so to speak.
Great.
She said, you know, "I will help you. I will personally introduce you to Pat Summitt. I will also allow you to run track and play basketball if you make the team. So if you still want to run, all I ask is you give me 1 year of track and field, completely just running track and field, and I will do my part to put you in front of Pat Summitt to help to let you make your case and do what you got to do."
Wow, that's an amazing, that's a gift.
You have a deal.
Yeah, that's a great deal. So
she gave me a scholarship, and I basically was able to run track, and in doing so, I ended up having a stellar year. She kept her word. I had a very good freshman year, and she kept her word, and she introduced me to, she made it so I would have a personal meeting with Pat Summitt. In that meeting, I would go to her and explain to her and show her, "You sent me a letter."
Yeah. Yeah.
On your radar.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I know that my name came up somewhere to be able to have this letter in my hand. I explained to her my athleticism. I told her I was the fastest thing you've ever seen on a basketball court. Yep. I was a defensive threat, an offensive threat with my speed. And that if she gave me a shot, I promised, you know, that she would not be disappointed. I wouldn't let her down. I also told her that it's been my dream to play for her in the University of Tennessee my entire life.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That, if she could just give me a chance, like basically I said something along the lines of, I would be one of the best players never seen if she didn't give me a chance.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
She said to me, she said, "You know, I don't have to do tryouts." And I was like, "Oh, I
really?"
It's a very funny conversation because I'm sitting in front of the person I literally idolize the most.
Absolutely.
That they have to give me a tryout.
And she's like, "You don't have to."
It's just, you know, it's actually kind of insane. But
that is insane.
She says to me, "You know, I don't have to do tryouts." And I said, "Coach, no disrespect. I 100% know that, you know, you probably have a line from here to Africa waiting on."
Right. Iconic here. Pat Summitt.
It's just, you know, I know.
That's amazing, Didi. Yeah.
"I'm just hoping you can give me a shot." And she said, "Well, I have to open a tryout to the whole school, but I'll definitely do it for you." So she gave me her word to hold the tryout the following season, and true to her word, she did. I ended up not being able to try out because, unfortunately, that coach that made that wonderful deal with me, she had to resign my freshman year.
Oh, wow.
And when she resigned, that created a new group of coaches that came in that had to then honor the agreement that I had with her. But they didn't really take the time to get to know me to understand the agreement.
or understand how it came into existence. And
wow,
and that created an issue between me and the coaches because they gave me an ultimatum, basically.
Okay.
The ultimatum was, even if you go and try out for the basketball team, we don't give you permission to participate in basketball. Therefore, we take your scholarship.
Right. We're not going to honor the scholarship. I was thought that would come next. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a great freshman year. I met up with Pat Summitt. I got to, you know, basically break down this, you know, give her my give me a chance speech.
Yes. Yes.
I told her, you know, to watch out for me. I'm going to really do my best to impress her.
Yeah.
And I did. I had a great freshman year and I ended up being SEC Athlete of the Week a couple times. And in doing so, there's a poster of me that goes up in the same office building as Pat Summitt's office.
Perfect.
And my poster ended up right in front of her door.
Yes, I love that. I love that. That's the ultimate statement. The ultimate.
I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
You couldn't tell me this wasn't destiny. I was like,
yes,
I'm setting this up so great. I didn't even have anything to do with that part. And I was like, wow, she has to literally see my face every day.
Every day walking into her office. Yeah, I love
it. It's awesome. So, and I was a standout. I had a standout year my freshman year. And it wasn't the most exceptional year. You know, I wasn't NCAA champion or anything like that. But for a freshman athlete, I had some pretty good stats. And it was like, oh, it's a great freshman year, you know?
Yes.
And a solid freshman year. And when I went home that summer, because again, you know, I stopped running summer track when I was like 16 or 17, I didn't run anymore. And so after track season was over, I went home. I didn't run track summer or for Junior Olympics or none of that. So
yeah,
I went home and I started training for basketball, you know, under the expectation that I was trying out for basketball coming that fall, which was the plan.
That's right.
And I got a call from JJ Clark and he says, you know, hey, we're the new coaches. Mm-hmm. When are you coming back to start training? And I say, I'm really coming back based on, you know, when school starts and when the mm-hmm. basketball tryout mm-hmm. is. He's like, basketball tryout? I was like, yeah, I have a basketball tryout. Mm-hmm. And he's like, can you come in a little early so we can, you know, talk about that?
Right.
And I showed up and they sat me down at the long conference table where there's like, you know, 20 chairs around it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they passed me a piece of paper. It said, you know, the NCAA rule state that an athlete in the smaller sport has to have permission from that sport to participate in the larger sport.
To the revenue, and yeah, the non-revenue to the revenue sport.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were not giving me permission to use my scholarship to play basketball. And that if I went to play basketball or even to the tryout, that I would forfeit my track and field scholarship. God. See, at that point, they're talking to me without having any knowledge of the pre-existing conversation, the pre-existing agreement I had. The dream that I've had since I was 10 years old. They don't know me. They just know me as ultimately their top female track and field athlete.
Yeah. And they're just trying to, in a business sense, try to protect their investment without understanding the context of what you can bring here to both programs.
Absolutely.
It's very, very
short-sighted. And they weren't willing to risk it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was more so one of those situations where ask questions before you hand out ultimatums.
Right.
Why do you want to play basketball?
Right.
How did this come about?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And then from that understanding, then there might've been different choices made, but
yeah, absolutely.
You know, I can't go, you know, at that point I couldn't go back. They can't go back. So it was a matter of just, you know, trying to fix it. So
yeah.
I left out of the room that day in tears. You know, yeah, heartbroken, devastated.
Yes, that's your lifelong dream. That's from your earliest moment.
And I went through so much to get there, you know, like,
yes,
didn't have the money to go to college, didn't get the proper recruitment, you know, situation. I'm already there on a, you know, a blessing and a whim, you know.
Yeah,
and
so, yes,
you know, and at that point, I call Pat Summitt and I say, Coach, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
Do you have a scholarship if I leave? Would I be able to get a scholarship? At that time, she didn't have anything. She would have the next scholarship she would have would be for 40% in February.
In February. Yeah.
And that means I would have to figure out, you know, out of state tuition at University of Tennessee for one semester.
Yeah. And she's not even seeing you play. I mean, you never even got to do the tryout at this point.
Exactly.
It shows to the integrity of Pat. Like, she's willing to do all these things. It's amazing. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I'm this is what's happened. I don't want to, you know, let you down or anything because you went out of your way to, you know, set this up. Yes. And, you know, you had to open it to the whole school. You know, you can't, it's not favoritism. You have to open it to the whole school to do it.
Right.
And now there's like, you know, a random assortment of people trying out for basketball who probably just don't have what it takes, you know.
Right. But, and she never would have had to do that before.
Exactly. I felt horrible.
Yeah, no.
And then I had to think of, well, you know, make a decision. Right. Either I completely lose my scholarship or I have to take this chance that I'm going to go and try out and make the team with Pat Summitt. And, but even if I made the team, she wouldn't have but 40% for me until the next fall. I would still have to come up with a significant amount of money.
Yeah. And with track and field, you had 100% grant and aid, I would imagine.
Yep. Yeah. I was on full. Yep.
Yep.
So I didn't know how to navigate that as a, you know, 19-year-old.
Of course not. No.
And I didn't know. I mean, at that time, obviously I had about 2 weeks to come up with, you know, 30K, you know, I just didn't know how to navigate that.
Right.
You know, so,
yeah, no, this feels like
a pretty clear cut situation.
Yeah. It just feels like one of your falls, a big speed bump in the road here. And what did you feel like it, to this point, this was kind of the lowest moment in your career or life overall? Was this a big moment before the 2008 surgery? So this really preceded that, obviously, and was a big moment. And how did you pivot on this? What turned you around?
Well, the ultimatum, and then ultimately making the decision to run track for what I felt was forcefully. It pretty much crippled my relationship with the sport. I think that's what created the 30-year connection to the passion or love for the sport, because I became resentful.
Of course, yes.
Of the sport, and I resented the coaches, I resented the program, I resented the everything about it. And for half a season, I would say I made sure they felt my resentment. I was, you know, Coach Clark had to threaten to send me home a couple times because I was selfishly running, with the mindset of, you know, if you put me on a 4x4 team and the whole team is comprised of, 1500 meter runners and we're in last place when I get the baton, please explain to me why I would run around the track and break my backbone to put us, you know, in last by 10 meters instead of I didn't understand the mentality of the sport because I never took the sport in a mentality to understand it. Even after a whole year of running as a freshman, I was literally just stepping on the line and doing what I was told, like, you say jump, how high? You say run, you how far?
Yeah.
You say win, how fast? Like, that's how I took it. I still never became a student of the game.
Right.
So to me, when you put me on a relay with three girls who run the 15, one who run the 15, run who runs 3K and run who runs 800, that tells me you're not trying to win the 4x4. So why would you put me on anchor leg and why would I kill myself when we're in last by over 100, by over 200 meters? We just got lapped there. This was indoors. We literally had got lapped and he wanted me to bust my hump.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand that mentality. My mentality was completely off the comprehensive. I wasn't able to comprehend how that was supposed to be training for me. Yeah. And so I would jog and he's like, why are you jogging? And I'm like, we were lapped. Like, what did you want me to do?
Right.
And so I was very ABC literal and very ignorant to the thing. And they didn't know that because, again, they think I run track.
Right. And so they're assuming a student of the sport when you're just coming into it, you know.
Exactly.
And you're thinking, okay, I'm in a performance mindset of just like kind of almost like a wild animal in a good way. Just hey, exactly. put me there and let me go, just like the playground, just coming up and running free, right? Yeah, exactly. It's awesome. It's the way it should be, though. I mean,
And that's the most bliss part of it. Sometimes that is the most bliss you can actually have in competing, is not knowing what, where, who, why. Or how, just go.
Yeah.
And I had a mentality of, you know, when is the purpose? Mm-hmm. You know, and when certain scenarios didn't make sense, it's just, it doesn't make sense to me. So they didn't understand that I wasn't a track athlete. I was a person participating in track.
Right. That happened and to be very, very fast.
Exactly. And so they were upset and frustrated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they thought I was being intentionally just like being a jerk.
Yeah.
And while my attitude with them was not pleasant, I was not intentionally being a jerk. I was ignorant to the mentality or the, you know, the process of training during the fall and all of that stuff. That was uncomprehendible for me.
Right. Yeah, it was, yeah, basketball time, you know.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Fall to winter, right? Right. we in 2 days is state championship, right? Coach says, hey, you want to do the deuce? You know? Like,
exactly.
Okay. Or I'll run half lap in the dome. That's fine.
Exactly. And they forgot that half of my season outdoors was spent with no coach. Mm-hmm. She had to resign during the very beginning of outdoor season. It was early outdoor season when Myrtle Ferguson had to resign from Tennessee.
Okay.
So in that time, I only had basically one semester. I only had the fall with her to even have a mild comprehension of how track and field worked and mm-hmm. all of mm-hmm. the things. And like I said, for me, it was the first time going through any of that. And I was literally just going through the motions, where, when, how, why, and that's all I needed to know. I don't need the details. I don't need any of that stuff. Just what time does the race start? Which one am I in? And like, just go. Like, that's all I need. But that made me very threatening. Yes. It made me a huge threat. Because when a person doesn't care and they're fearless, mm-hmm. but they have a hunger to be competitive and a drive to like just to kick butt. When you have that kind of mentality, and you don't know what's, you know, who you should be concerned about. And you don't know, like, you're like a huge threat.
Yeah.
So that's why I was so like great. One of the things that made me great was just my ignorance to the whole thing.
Yes.
And so they were frustrated. I was frustrated. And so that whole, my whole sophomore year was, you know, a bunch of, you know, back and forth, anger moments between me and Coach Clark and Coach Carroll. Ultimately the final straw for Coach Carroll was, Coach Carroll was really my coach. JJ was the head coach, but Carol Smith Gilbert was the head sprint coach for the women.
That makes sense.
And, so I was dealing with her on a daily basis, and I'll never forget. We were at the SEC quad meet at South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you're running the 400. And I was like, I don't run the 400.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm like, you guys just got here. You took basketball away. Now you're going to put me in an event I don't do. You know, like this is just great.
Right.
And so they're like, no, you're running the 400 this week. And I was like, okay. So I get out on the track. And at this, I've like, you know, I like I said, my resentment and my anger has like mounted up. I'm just kind of really just done ultimately.
Yeah.
And I get on the track and the gun goes off and I jog the whole 400 meters.
Oh no. Okay.
Literally jog the race.
So your emotions had reached a boiling point from the defensiveness of, obviously they took your dream away. And then these are whole new coaching regime comes in, and, you know, you don't know them. They don't know you. And it's just all this bubbled up, and there you are at SEC. And
Okay. Well, we're at the quad meet.
At the quad meet.
It's not pre-SEC. A major championship.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just some shenanigans on the side.
Got it. Okay. Got it.
And she says, you know, so when I finish the race, she's like, you know, her face is red, like she's steaming.
Yeah.
And she's like, okay, what do we got to do? You know, mm-hmm. what's going on?
Yeah.
And I explained it to her. I said, you guys came in here. You didn't know me. You didn't even try to get to know me. You took a dream away from me, or you put me in a position to make a decision for a dream that I've had since I was 10 years old without right. even asking me. Then yeah. you mock me. You make jokes and things. Oh, you thought you were going to play for the Lady Vols and all this, you know, without even knowing the magnitude of how painful a joke like that is to me.
Right.
And, you know, there right. was things that had happened along the way that I just continued to make me feel like just rage, you know? Ugh. And so I explained that to her and I said, you know, I'm just, and now the final straw, you're just going to start throwing me around in different events. Like it's just another version of you guys haven't even taken a chance to get to know who you're dealing with or who your athletes are. You just came in here and start pushing everybody around. Like I feel bullied. You know?
On assumptions, yeah, and then all this, yeah, separate and exclusionary, you know, with this language of sitting at a conference table with an ultimatum on a piece of paper, which is
exactly
doesn't make
which
sense.
Which is tough, and I'm a kid. I'm yeah. ultimately yeah. I'm 19 years old. It doesn't feel good, no. you know, and I at this point, you know, as intelligent as a kid as I think I was mature, and I should it's more mature than anything. Mm-hmm. There's still things that I wasn't able to manage mentally as it pertained to how things were unfolding.
That makes
sense. You know, and I was dealing with it from a place of heartbreak as well.
Yes.
You know, so
yes.
I had that conversation with her. Then she, you know, explained to me she didn't know. And it's like, of course you didn't know. You didn't ask, you know?
That's right.
And we had a heart to heart that day and she said, okay. I'm going to let you run whatever you want to run, but at SCCs, you run the 400.
Okay.
So if you want to run the 100 and the 200 and do the long jump, I'm 100% for it. We'll enter you in there and there. And at Georgia, we'll do this, you know, this, that, and the third. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But at SCCs, if you could run the 400 for me, that how does that sound? So you have a deal. Okay. So I made a deal with her and, you know, I did the 100, I did 200. I did well at the 200. I was on the descending order list is what was the process at the time was, you know, top 21 times or something like that, or top 18 times. I can't remember.
Regionals. Yeah.
We didn't have regionals at the time.
Oh, okay. It was pre-regionals. Got it. Yeah.
Pre-regionals. It was descending mm-hmm. order list. So okay. top times in the country.
Got
top
it.
18 yep. times in the country. And if you were on the bubble, I think it was 19 or 20, you're on the bubble.
Went to nationals. Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I was on the descending order list for the 200. I was higher up on the 400 list. I ended up higher on the 400 list, but I was on both lists. But the way that the schedule was set up, you really couldn't do both events. So you had to choose one at that time. And so SECs was at Tennessee for the first time in many years for track and field.
At home. Okay.
Yeah. At home.
Okay.
And, the reason my attitude shifted, and these are kind of monumental moments, I guess you can say.
Yes.
I still wasn't gung-ho about running the 400, but she had, you know, we made a deal. And, you know, if you haven't put together my personality type, woman of my word, I make
right.
deals.
Exactly. Yeah.
I make commitments. I follow
yeah.
through.
Yeah.
So.
Honoring that. Yeah.
She kept her word. So I was going to keep mine. And when it came time for the race, I'd say maybe leading up to it, I would say the day before, I believe it was the day before the prelims, I started to get these little comments from people like, just do the best you can. Mm-hmm. You know, don't worry about anything, you know, like mm-hmm. sympathetic, like, mm-hmm. ugh, it just makes me feel gross.
Yeah.
And I just had like, I'm like, why are you talking to me? Like, I'm going to lose. Get out of my face. And it yeah. made me so angry,
uh-huh.
but in
uh-huh.
a motivational way.
So that fierceness and, came back. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The more it seemed like they thought I was just like, just do the best you can.
Yeah.
And you know, don't worry about anything. Like,
right.
who do you guys think you're talking to? I'm right. an animal.
Right.
Get out of here.
A killer. Yeah. I got to be exactly. out there.
Get out of here. So yeah. the more it seemed like they didn't think I could do it or win. Mm-hmm. That it just I said, I'm gonna show y'all.
That's right.
And just like that, I said, oh, you guys think I can't do it. I see the little pity in your eyes and the little sympathetic voices. I get it. And now I'm gonna tell you where you can put all those. And uh-huh. so I was at that very moment, a light clicked off in my head when I got those little tones and little vibrations from them, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
I said, oh no, I'll win it just because I don't like how you guys talk to me.
Love
so,
that.
So that's literally amazing. That's how I beat Hazel Ann Regis, who was leading the world in the 400. She was a world leader at the time. And I won the SEC title at Tennessee.
You won the title there. Yeah.
Yep. And I did it in a time of 50.66.
50.6. Yeah, that's fast.
Running the world leading time, breaking Hazel Ann Regis's time that she set, and beating her all at the same time.
Well, your first time in the four as well.
First time in the four, the real deal, like first time running it.
That's remarkable.
And, you know, they were like, yeah. And I'm like, if you only knew the motivation behind this was those little ridiculous voice and tones that you guys had.
Yeah.
So like I said, I picked up on anything I could to make, you know, to make it make sense for me for a while. And so, from there, what I didn't realize about the sport and that I learned, I guess, you know, race by race is that one good race leads to another and one good race pushes you into another.
That's right.
So as you do well in one, as long as you keep placing top three, you almost don't get a choice but to go to the next one. You kind of have to, right? So that's a progressional situation. Yeah. I didn't really realize all that. Yeah. So I went to SECs. I won the title. I knew NCAAs was ahead. I had been there the year before. So we went to NCAAs. I chose the 400 because, well, I chose the 400. We selected the 400 because I was higher on the list.
Okay.
Ended up getting second place at NCAAs. I was runner up to Sonya Richards.
Fantastic, right there. Yeah, that's a prelude to other good things to come, like 2012, the bronze.
Yeah, and I had no idea who she was. She was like, literally, I had no idea who Sonya Richards was. She could have literally been the biggest name in the world. And I would have been like, who's that? I had no idea.
Even better that you didn't
exactly
know.
Exactly. I had no idea who I was racing. That race, I was tricked into going to USA's. I was told that if I just won more race, literally they were taking it. I honestly think they were taking it. JJ and Carol, they'll probably laugh if they hear this, podcast.
Yeah. They will, I'm sure.
You know, I think they were somewhat taking advantage of my ignorance of the sport and how, you know, as you win, you know, how you continue to move on. I didn't understand that, or they just were blown away that I didn't understand that. So either way, either they were kind of playing on that, or they had no idea that I was that ignorant.
Yeah.
So,
all they knew is we had a diamond. We have a diamond and we're going to market right now.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to keep pushing it. So we're going to keep pressing it.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh, we entered you in USA's one more race. I said, wait a minute. That's it for college. What do you mean one more race? They were like, just one more. It's one more. It's in Palo. I think it was Palo Alto.
Okay.
It's Stanford. I believe so. Yeah. I believe it was at Palo Alto.
Yeah.
They were like, just one more race. One more race. And I was like, oh God. Okay. Just one more race. We already got you there. No, was it Sacramento? I don't remember, but it was in California and it was, not too far from where the NCAAs were held. So, we went up there and I was like, okay, it's no big deal. Just one more race. And when I got there, it's not one more race. It's one more championship, which means three rounds.
A lot of rounds. Yes.
I was so upset. I was like, what? You said one more race. This is three more races.
Yeah.
And I had no idea about this world at all. Completely oblivious to the USA track and field thing. And so I said, you guys said one more race. This is three more races. It's not what you said. And they were like, oh, well, it only might be two races because there's a shortage on people who entered the 400.
They may drop out of a trial and go right to a quarter.
2003, we had very few people show up for the 400, the women's 400.
Oh, interesting.
So we went straight to the semifinal.
Uh-huh.
So we had a very small field. We went to the semifinals and we went straight to the finals and I got third in the finals. True story. And Phil, you're just getting the real, cause I don't really tell people this
That's
part.
That's fantastic. I love this. This is so good.
I was so tired
Yeah.
by then. And I felt tricked that in the 400 finals, when I was coming around the last 100, I saw that I was in third place. I had an extra kick in me, but I was like, third is fine. Third is the last race. Like, it doesn't even matter. Like,
that's amazing.
See, the craziest thing about this is that I had no idea that top three.
That you were going to go to Worlds.
They kept me in the dark.
Like top six, you're going to be on a relay. You don't even top six. Like, you're going to get like funding. You're going to get like insurance. Like those, all these things that didn't even register. Like
they didn't
professional.
Tell me.
Like you're coming into like just making the final. Like I could get a contract. Like professional. All this stuff. Like,
no idea. Still no idea.
Amazing.
These things were left out of the fine print. Okay.
So they had kid gloves. Like we've got this jewel here, but we don't want it. We want to keep sort of in the dark so that we can sort of manipulate it into one race at a time.
Yes.
Very strange mentality.
I literally think they had a secret plan going to say,
oh yeah,
this kid is awesome. She doesn't know how awesome she is at the sport. Or if she does, she doesn't care. And what we want to try to do is give her the best chance we possibly can to have a successful career. And we're looking at it from a standpoint of, hey, you know,
she's your own worst enemy.
Exactly. So let's keep her in the dark a little bit and just, you know, we'll explain it to her one thing at a time. So I had no idea that I thought this was the last race because they said it was the last race, right? One more race,
right? A championship, right?
Yes. I had no idea.
With rounds.
Exactly. And it didn't feel very much like a big deal because at that point, USA Track and Field was, you know, not the smoke and glitter is not there like it was, like it wasn't there like it is now.
Like it is now.
And,
exactly.
You know, at this point, nobody even showed up to run the 400. So I'm not seeing the prestige. I'm not seeing the beauty in all of this. It doesn't seem like a professional environment to me.
And television, folks, is highlights. This is not live streaming on. There's not an Olympic channel. You know, it's very, you know, Flow Track is not even a thing yet.
Nope.
Those guys
no
came out.
Media for
they came out in 2007, you know, to us and Flag. So, you know, it's very limited access to this. Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, that being the case and then having it be a really flat year, I don't think they had another year like that since 2003. I've never seen another year in my time where we didn't have enough people to run the rounds.
Yeah, that's so, very strange.
Yeah. So whatever happened in 2003 never happened again. But it definitely didn't seem like a professional environment. I had no idea this was a professional track meet. It just didn't feel very professional.
Yeah.
It definitely wasn't glamorous, you know? Right. So I was like, what is this? Okay. One more race. All right. Well, where is it? And what do we got to do? Right. And so I looked up and I was like, oh, well, I'm in third place. Now I had an extra kick in me and I was like, but third place is fine. And nobody's really behind me. So, you know, this is fine. This is the last race. It really doesn't matter. What do I get for this? I don't get a trophy. I don't get like, what is this? Like, I didn't see the purpose in the race.
Right.
So I just was like, third is fine. And I literally comfortably kept myself in third and
you shut
just
it down,
ran on
coasted,
through.
Yep. Coasted in. Yeah.
And if I had known that it took three, I probably would have figured out a way to get four. So,
I gotcha. Wow.
Because at that point, I was definitely not interested in running anymore.
I
want
to go home. I want to go back to Decatur. I'm done.
Exactly.
I'm out. Enough of this Vol Nation. I got to get home. I got to reset. I got to get to my friends.
Right. Terrible.
Yeah.
So, I crossed the finish line and I was like, whew, okay, great. This is over. I'm tired. And I get rushed into a press conference. And so, which I didn't know was a press conference. Everybody's so happy. I'm like, why is everybody so happy? And I get sat at the table and I kid you not, Phil, they sit me down at the table. All these cameras are in front of us with the microphones and all those big giant boom mics and stuff.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I'm sitting there and they have a little name card for me. And then Demetria Washington, Sonya Richards,
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is going on here? And they're like,
So Dee Dee, how does it feel to be going to make the world championship team and be going to Paris? I was like, excuse me? What did you just say?
I got to talk to my coaches. Wait a minute here.
Right. So obviously I'm sitting in front of the camera. So I play it off. I was like, yeah, it's really exciting. Yeah, it's great. And I'm literally like, smoke is coming out of my ears.
Oh,
I'm
my
like,
gosh.
How could they set me up to sit here and be so unprepared and like in shock? Like, you know, and I'm like, Paris. Now, keep in mind, I have never left the country. I do not have a passport.
Don't know passport.
I have never, ever, you know, so this is bigger in my mind than even That's comprehensible.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
What and did you just do? Like what? That.
Oh, my gosh.
I walked off and I said, you guys did not tell me this. So what is going on?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you made the world championship team and that's in Paris. And so you'll go there and you'll run the 400 and it's three rounds. Okay. So another three, you said one more track meet. That's another whole track meet.
Right.
And I was like okay,
another 6 weeks, right? With training camp and all the stuff.
Another country. And again, none of this stuff had really any allure to me because, you know, I didn't have any experience with international travel or even any seeds planted to go,
That's right.
And so, it was, you know, kind of a lot to take in. And as I, you know, came to terms with it, we went to the post office. I got the, you know, the passport and everyone's super excited. You made the world team. Yeah. And I'm like, yay, I was tricked on the world team, you know, like, and I still have no knowledge of the people I'm running against, you know. And I get to the worlds and I ran in the 400. I made the semifinals. Okay. I didn't make the finals by a few spots. I ran the prelim of the 400. I mean, the 4x4 relay. I did exceptionally well on my leg. And then I realized that track and field has a lot of politics.
Yes. Yes.
And that.
Especially when it comes to relays.
Yep. And I said, this is why I don't fool with this because
it's
a lot of different shenanigans here when it comes to all of this. It's not always based on who's the best and, you know, how well you do at something. And so that is something I wasn't a big fan of because I'm also a stickler for fairness.
Yeah, that's good.
And doing what's right, you know? And so
when
I felt exactly. Mm-hmm. And when I felt like there was a lot of this, you know, just wrongdoing, I was turned off to the sport again, especially on what was now being told to me as the professional level. And I was like, oh, I would never want to do this because they don't, you know, this isn't right. That wasn't right how they did me and they did other people wrong. And they ran someone on the relay who was not running faster than me, who didn't even make the team individually. So how do you justify
somebody else in?
Yeah. How do you justify running a person who didn't make who I beat two times, putting them, you know, like it didn't make sense to me. And I didn't understand that because my world is you put the fastest people, you put the people who've earned the spot. Like,
that should never make sense to you. Quite honestly, that should never.
No,
make
it
sense.
Shouldn't.
Yeah.
It was wrong then. It'd be wrong now, you know, and it's wrong no matter how you slice and dice it. So I was like, oh, if this is how we do things, I don't want to be a part of this, you know?
So and you're so, thinking, this is all cutting into my summer. This is not good. Ultimately.
I had a really great time in Paris and I'm glad that, you know, I was kind of tricked into the whole thing because I saw the Mona Lisa, you know, we went on a private tour of the Louvre.
The Louvre,
I went to the Eiffel Tower. We went on a private tour up the Eiffel Tower and to the top.
So now you're seeing the world, amazing. You're seeing another culture.
Awesome. It was a wonderful experience. So there was definitely a better summer, you know, you know, being at home.
Right.
And
and
it was free. I didn't pay for anything,
that's
you know,
right. That's
minimal complaints there, you know, so minus the, you know, the unfair 4x4 final relay selection where I was, you know, cut out of the final without good reason.
That's right.
And just
side note, Gerald Miles Clark did fight for me. And I like to put that out there because a lot of people just don't stand up for their, for things that are wrong. And when she saw this and she didn't think it was right, she stood up for me and she wanted explanation. And, you know, and then in 2004, something similar happened to her. And
I remember that. Yeah. She's a person of great integrity. Yeah.
Come on, man. Yep. And, you know, it's just one of those things I just like to highlight because so often those things are left out. But
that's right.
You know, and so that kind of put a bad taste in my mouth. But when I got home, I still never really women's track and field in 2003 is milestones away from where it was back then.
That's right.
And so I still, it just did not have a allure to it at all.
Yeah. Well, it didn't have an infrastructure. It didn't have funding. I mean, there was so many things that it lacked. Right.
And it was not appealing at all.
That makes total sense.
So I still was not thinking about embarking on that journey professionally. Right. I was like, I'm coming back to school. I'm going to get my degree and go somewhere. But when I returned back to school, something earlier that you referenced, you know, the calls, you know, to go professional and all that and making that decision. When they called after I got back from Paris, it was, you know, hey, we would like Dee Dee to go pro.
Adidas opportunity. Okay. Okay.
I'm not sure who was calling at the time.
Okay.
I believe it was agents.
Got it.
And so
that makes sense.
The agents were saying, and I was kind of in the dark because I'm not allowed to talk to them and I'm not allowed to, you know, so I was just informed that there were inquiries about me going professional.
Coming back from world champs now. Okay. Yep. Back to school. Got it.
And there were inquiries about me going professional and, you know, the reference was to, you know, if I went professional, it would be something around $40,000. Contract. And I immediately walked out, said, no, thank you. Goodbye. I can make $40,000 as being a manager at McDonald's was what I said. Exactly.
Good for you. Yeah.
And, I said, no, that's thanks. Right. I didn't come to college to get to work that hard to get 40K. I'm sorry. That doesn't add up for me. I don't love track and field enough for that.
Right. Exactly.
And so that's what I told them. And I was getting ready to leave the office and they said, but there was a, but. They said, if you beat Sonya Richards, that deal turns into a 6-figure deal. And I said, who's that? I'm just telling you the true story.
That girl from
true
Texas.
That girl true from story. Texas. They said, I said, and who's that? And they said, they said the girl you just ran with at the world championship.
Yeah. Yeah.
I said, which one?
And oh, Dee Dee, so, that's great. That
I'm
is
so
great.
Serious, Phil.
That is I great. Tell you, I love
I was
that.
A walking blank. Okay. I just was so selfishly folk. I just could not jump on the track and field bandwagon. Yeah. I just was not in it for the titles, the names, the recognition or who's. I could care less. I just got second place to the girl at NCAAs. I just got third place to her at USA. I just ran on the world championship team with her, and I still could not put a face to a name. I did not know.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of athletes could learn a lot from this. They'll be coming up instead of diving into social media and trying to
pay less attention.
Yeah. Like, hey, self-referral. It starts with internal here. God's giving you a message. He's telling you to run, but he's not telling you to pay attention to other people. So you focus on what you're doing, on burning that one lap around a track, which, by the way, is one of the hardest events in track and field. For those that don't know, it's one of the grueling races in track. So,
absolutely, it is the beast of all beasts. Yep. It is the monster of the track and field. And
that's right.
You know, I couldn't figure out who was who, and they were like, just don't worry about it. You just the girl that was, you know, that was at NCAAs, and they just started putting, you know, locations. So I said, oh, okay. I said, now what's the deal? I just got to beat her. And they were like, yeah. And I said, done. And I walked out the office.
Yes. Bring it on.
I literally love that version of myself. Fearless, careless, fearless, carefree.
Yes.
Just
a samurai, a warrior.
Yeah, man.
A samurai.
Very literal. I was such a literal person.
Yeah.
How high, how far, fast, and get out of the way so I can do it. Just move out of the way.
Right. Just
and don't say anything stupid. And if you say something that's too stupid, I'll probably use it as motivation to make to do it even harder. Right.
Just like, just tell me I can't. Just tell me I can't. Exactly. Yeah. Don't don't try to sugarcoat it. It's all go to mental health. Let's keep her motivated here. You know.
Oh yeah, the exact opposite. Yeah. I was such a fearless warrior. And I was so literal about everything.
Yeah.
And I was mad.
Yeah.
You know? So there's some things you couldn't, like, some people, they say, oh, if you do this, you do that, you could have beat her. I was so mad internally, I could have beat anybody at that.
That's right.
There was just something in me that was just angry, burning on fire. And I didn't even know I was mad. I was just, you know, it was just me at the time, you know?
That's right.
I look back at it now and I realized it was, you know, I was working with some internal frustration and things like that. But at the time, this is just who I am. And this is just how I am. Mm-hmm. I walked out of the office. I said, I just got to beat that girl done. And I walked out.
That's amazing.
I told them, these are exact words. I said, I can make $40K as a manager at McDonald's. No, thank you.
No, thank you.
I don't see myself working that hard outside running around for $40K. No, thank you. And so I was, they say, oh, well, hold on. There's a but.
Another offer on the table here.
Yeah. you beat Sonya Richards.
Yeah.
You, it's six figures. Okay. I said, now you're talking. Done. Let's go.
Let's go. Yeah. So this was at the next NCAA. It was this outdoor that you won the NCs against
2004.
2004.
At University of Texas.
Yeah.
On the biggest headwind I've ever seen on the backstretch.
On her home track.
Home track and broke her school record, her track record.
That'll get some attention from some agents and some shoe companies there. Yeah.
And at the time, she had already kind of set her deals in motion to go pro in 04. Okay. And this was another pivotal moment for track and field because 2004 was the shift for women's track and field.
That's right.
$40,000 contracts went to 80 to 100 to 100 plus. And from then on, it's never looked back.
That's right. That's right.
We were the pivotal moment for salaries to be respectable for women's track and field.
That's it's a monumental moment. That was a monumental moment.
And as I crossed the finish line that day, and Sonya crossed the finish line that day, and Monique Henderson crossed the finish line that day, we became history makers, so to speak, I guess you can say.
Absolutely.
And I would sign that 5-year deal with Adidas. Sonya would sign with Nike, I believe. And I think her contract was already, you know, in motion to some degree, you know, kind of similar, you know, everyone had an expectation, something motivate them to go, you know, and make something happen.
Right.
And, you know, I got home and it's just another mental thought. I got home and I saw the commercials leading up to the women's 400. It was like Sonya Richards, Monique Henderson, who will win the women's 400? And they did this cool like side by side thing where Sonya was running on one side and Monique was running on the other side. They had like a split screen thing going.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, that's funny. I was like, guess they weren't counting on this crazy maniac.
I love that. The ghost. Yeah.
The streak of orange that no one saw coming.
That's so fantastic.
That race is one of my favorite races because it was more about running smart than running to win.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a backstretch. It was a huge storm in Texas that year, made us cancel one of the rounds. It rained and flooded and everything, lightning and thunder. It went on so long that they couldn't continue the meet.
Oh, they delayed. So they took out the semi. Okay.
I don't remember if they took it out or if they did a combination or I don't remember how they repaired the day.
Okay.
But we lost the first round. And somehow we had to make it up some kind of way or they did something to make it right. And going into the final, that weather was just atrocious and it brought in a wind that I don't think I ever raced again with a wind that strong on the backstretch.
Oh my
gosh. I remember seeing Sonya and Monique just blazing down the backstretch. Like they were in such deep competition with each other, I think.
They did.
And maybe they
about,
saw the commercials.
Right. They believe their own hype. They believe themselves. Yeah. It was just them.
Yeah. I guess. And you know, and they definitely weren't counting on me to, you know, get in the mix. So
that's great.
They were gone. I mean, they were a good 50 meters ahead of me, I feel like, when they came around the 200 turn. And I was on the backstretch like, this wind is ridiculous. I remember kind of just being in my own world and everyone was gone. I was in last place coming around the 200, coming to the 200. And then as soon as I felt the wind cut off of me, I was like, oh, now you go. And
okay.
I took off and it looked like I started a whole new race. And they were worn out from running in that backstretch like there was no wind there.
Okay.
And I ran right past them.
Wow.
And the last 50 meters, it came up, goodbye, and it was over.
And what a defining moment that just catapulted you into international prominence there with the ability to get that contract to continue, even reluctantly, right? but to continue it, and it becomes a breakthrough for women's sport, not just, you know, so it's bigger than you at this point. So you're sort of fulfilling that purpose. And take us to that other low point, Dee Dee. I know that in 2008, now, what was the actual injury, the knee surgery? There was a disruption. It was a hole in your femur. I mean, what actually happened?
Yeah.
What led up to that?
So, you know, initially we thought I had, you'll read articles and things, and I'm glad I get a chance to kind of clarify this.
Yeah.
You read articles that'll say, you know, the car door hit me in the knee. And I think relatively accurate. Yeah, the car door did bounce back and hit me in the knee, but I think it hurt because the injury was already there.
Okay.
In hindsight, you know, I just kind of look back and it's just the chondrofemoral defect is what it's termed.
Okay.
And basically it's like layman's term is you have a hole in your femur.
Yes.
And it's at the tip where you're in the inside where your knee is at. And this surgery is called microfracture surgery. At the time, it was relatively new, a relatively new procedure. And it was a one shot. You do the microfracture surgery. If you somehow interrupt that healing process, you don't get a redo. It's a one time. Mm-hmm. Give it a go. If it works, good for you. But they were saying at the time, 90% of athletes don't actually recover from this to perform the way they used to.
Yeah, that was very early on in the microfracture surgery.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was very, very early on. It didn't have a good success rate at the time. It didn't have a good success rate for the athlete being able to come back and be like world class. Like
to return. Yeah, turn to the sport.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That level.
So is success. Yeah. Are you able to walk around and be normal? Sure. Yeah. But are you going to be able to long jump and, you know, do all this kind of stuff? Probably not. Yeah. So the surgery and the injury itself for me came out of nowhere. I didn't hurt myself. I was just, you know, normal one day and the next day my knee was swollen.
Mm.
And, you know, then I'm looking for explanations. I'm like, how did this happen?
Right.
And, you know, I'm still to this day, I don't really know how it happened. So much as, you know, it's just not there one day and the next day it was.
Yeah. So maybe repetitive stress, and then the car door was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back and identified
possibly. Exactly. And when I think back, I'm just like, I just never have any, I had no warning for that. It was no warning. I didn't have, oh, this is bothering me a little bit, or this is bothering me a little bit, or, you know, it's just nothing there one day and not the, you know, not one day it wasn't there one day and the next day it was, you know?
Yeah.
And so, that surgery happened in fall of 2008, but not after I gave it one more go, because hearing that it had a low success rate, I said, well,
you thought this is your final,
This is
my final go at it. You know, at track maybe.
So I better try to figure it out with the hole in my knee. So, the fragments were in the knee, the fluid space of the knee.
Mm-hmm.
We could do the the microfracture, I mean, the scope, but if we open the knee up, you know, I'm not going to be able to come back for the season.
No way.
So
no.
It was just a matter of having to run with it. I had an awesome orthopedic surgeon. Was Dr. Mathian, Gregory Mathian. He's one of the key people who made 2008 a possible season for me.
And
I say one of, because everybody was on this train. Benny Vaughn was on the train to help me get right.
Yeah.
I had so many awesome therapists who just really went above and beyond to try to make sure that they could help me with minimizing all of the impact and just everything. Even the company that was really on the brink at the time, who were newly introduced into sports, was Don Joy.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, you won't see an NFL. I mean, you won't see college players. Everyone's wearing Don Joy knee braces. You know, it's a thing. So,
yeah. I love how you give credit to all your therapists and all the sponsors and the people you know, just so it warms my heart to see that as a longtime therapist in the sport so it's so great that you're honoring us and understanding that we're the team behind the dream and sometimes don't
absolutely.
Get
absolutely
yeah so.
There is absolutely 0% of a chance of doing anything that I did from 2004 all the way to the end of my career without the chiropractors, the massage therapists.
Yes.
And I had my Knoxville team, Dr. Petty, Kim. My Knoxville team was everything for me. You know, I had, it's just a really phenomenal group of people who dedicated their countless hours and made it affordable to be there every day or every other day. You know,
they
dedicated their lives to us.
That's right. That's right.
And if you don't see it that way, there's you're missing the bigger picture.
Yeah.
These people are dedicating their lives to help you live your dream.
That's right. That's a mission. Yep.
So Kim Field, Dr. Petty, I wish I could shout out every single one of them, but you know, it's just so many wonderful people I've come across that I have a Rolodex of awesomeness in my phone.
That's so great.
I ended up coming back and, you know, in 2008, fought my way to the Olympic team, you know, and it was not an easy journey. I failed multiple times along the way. But that journey gave me the story that I'm still sharing to this day around the world with people of all ages, all walks of life. It is literally the cornerstone of how I was able to create turn one blessing into another, basically.
That's right. Because basically that idea of the adversity advantage, Dee Dee, is like all those things that you came through have come to define you. And it's so beautiful when you tell your story, these amazing speeches that I've gotten the pleasure of seeing, you know, not live, unfortunately, yet. But I want to see one of your things live because it's so moving as you speak from the heart because you've suffered. You've been in that suffering and you've come through the other side. Through God's grace and through what you've been able to manifest through the mission, and take us through what happened after this post-surgery of 2008, because I think from that point leading up to this amazing 2012 campaign, something like for 3 years you didn't win a race. People don't understand. It wasn't just magical. Okay, here I am, 2007 national champion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just going to arrive. I'm it. I'm the stuff. And you come back and you realize, hey, I'm not the same athlete yet. And you've got to crawl back. Take us through some of those feelings and emotions that are happening. What was that process like of coming back?
The comeback created what I now call the mental champion mindset.
Right.
And now I've created an entire program around helping other athletes get to the mental, to really harness what it means to be a mental champion.
That's right.
And I took everything from 2008 to 2011, and I almost parts of it was very difficult because I started to lose in many ways. I was losing races physically. I was losing confidence. Mm-hmm. I was losing supporters. I was losing money.
Sponsors.
You know, I lost my 5-year contract with Adidas. Mm-hmm. I ended up having to sign a deal with Saucony for 3 years. It was a 3-year deal with Saucony, and it was for 50% less than what I was making with Adidas. And, you know, and I just, there was a lot of the surgery. It did what it was expected to do. She's not going to be able to come back. She should retire.
Right.
You know, it's people started, you know, like I said, you started to lose your supporters, confidence, everything. And
because on paper, it's supposed to be a career ending injury. I mean, that's on paper. And so on here paper. You are moving through that and saying, look, I can, I will, I must. And those are the things that you've lived by. And it's just remarkable.
I kept pushing, Phil, even though everything was saying, you know, everything against me was saying, you know, this is over. It's a wrap.
Right.
Something in me kept saying, keep trying. You can, you must, you will. Keep going, keep going. And I decided that I kept trying to be, I think you mentioned this earlier. Sometimes you just have to change with the That's change. Right. And when life changes you, you can't keep trying to be who you used to be anymore. You got to find a new way to win.
That's right.
And when I took that mentality into effect, I said, just start over.
Beautiful.
Take everything that you have gone through. It's the blueprint. The map.
That's right.
It's not something to dwell on. It's not something to be sad about. It's not something to depress you. It is the blueprint of what it's going to take to win. Go back through the map and pull it together.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Find the treasure at the end of the where X marks the spot.
That's
you know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I went back through and I used all of the hurt, all of the disappointment, all of the failure, all of the loss, 3 years of getting loss after loss. I couldn't break 51 seconds outdoors. Mm-hmm. You know, I just was in a impossible rut. Okay. Yeah. And as I approached 2012, I literally mapped it out. I started to write everything down. I started to put everything written in a place where I have to see it every day. I started to speak over the negativity. I started to speak positive mantras.
So now you're changing your brain. So now you're doing this biohacking
champion.
And you're getting, you're doing that brain elasticity and you're using the mantras. Perfect.
I'm creating a mental warrior because physically I was doing okay. And I didn't realize that I had these mental barriers because I'm so used to being a beast.
Right. Right.
That
just
I couldn't
able to
even
step in
tail.
And go. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. And I needed to change my mental infrastructure because I also needed to change my mental approach to my physical approach to training.
That's right.
So everything had to be revamped. So I left Knoxville. I moved to Orlando, where Coach Carroll had relocated to UCF.
Okay.
She had been coaching me virtually with the help of Coach Norbert Elliott, who was coaching me in the physical and in the and him and Carroll were working together to create workouts for me.
Great.
I did not want to leave Knoxville.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to leave Knoxville during the early years of my surgery because that's where my entire support system was at. My personal trainer,
surgical team,
everyone's there. I felt like it would just debilitate my career and give me less of a chance of recovering if I left all of these people behind. And keep in mind, I'm making 50% less than I was before. So having people who are loyal and dedicated to just helping me get better,
They're in on the mission. Yeah, they're in on the mission. They're not worried about the monetary gains. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so I ultimately put together a new strategy. I went to Orlando. I met a weight training coach there. He may be at Georgia still now. I'm not sure. But he's awesome coach. And he was able to help me get back into Olympic lifting without re-injuring myself.
Perfect. Corrective exercise, moving forward, getting stronger.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the mental game. And then there's the spiritual side as well. reconnecting with God in a way that helped to create those positive mantras on a day-to-day basis. And it was through those situations and those different changing moments, or the shift in mental preparation, mental champion mindset, that I was able to to get over that hump, is what I should call it.
Yes.
And in 2012, I started out the year running indoors, thinking, I got this. And I ran indoors and I ran 51.77. I was like, oh yeah, I'm back, you know. And
it's a great opener.
Then I was getting ready. I was like, Coach Carol was like, well, you're good. Now you can just wanted to see if, you know, how your training was going. So you're good there. And she's like, you can shut it down. I was like, no, I want to go to USA's. So I go to USA's and I'm so glad I went. If I hadn't went to USA's, I wouldn't have discovered what I ended up finding out. I was running in the race and I made it to the finals, and the gun goes off. I'm running around the track, the first lap, and Natasha Hastings, Natasha, okay. And I believe it was even Sonya that year who decided to run indoors, but I could be wrong, but definitely Natasha Hastings came flying past me on the turn. And when she passed me, this voice in my head said, shut it down, it's over. And I was like, what? Now, mind you, I've never heard this voice before.
Wow.
And I've definitely never heard it in a race.
Okay.
So it was super loud and clear.
Okay.
And it says, shut down. And my body listened.
Oh, and you just shut down. Yeah.
And I shut down for a hot second. And I said, what? Like I was in a mental tug of war with myself during the race. So for a split second, as she passed me, muscle memory kicked in from all the years of getting passed at that point, and the results being what they are, no matter how hard I tried, that when I physically had the ability to actually do something about that situation,
to keep moving,
the muscle memory of the repetitive loss kicked in spoke so loud. It said, shut down, it's over. And my body listened for like a split second. It shut off.
Wow.
And I was like, what? And the other part of me that's awoke and completely conscious was like, no. And then I surged up again.
Okay.
And then it was like, you're not going to catch the another voice. You're not going to catch them. And I was like, and it shut down, and the body shut down again. I was like,
whoa.
So what the heck?
Foot on the gas, foot on the brake idea.
Man.
With the neurologically and these old neural patterns of thought too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. I had never experienced anything like it before. I was in a mental race with myself the entire race. I lost, clearly.
Yeah,
I believe I got second or third. Third. Maybe it was third, because I want to say Sonya was in the race that year. She doesn't run indoor very often, but I want to say she ran.
She might have run. Okay.
And her and Hastings, I think they got first and second, and I believe I got third. And I was so mad that I lost. And it wasn't because they beat me. It was because I beat myself. I couldn't figure it out. And I was like, that has never happened to me before, and it will never happen again.
There you go. Yeah.
And I could not, I would have never exposed that mental confidence issue, or the repetition of loss that had created this muscle memory of physical shutdown in me. That
it was a huge awareness moment. Yeah, it was a huge awareness. A huge, just to find that out in a race that doesn't matter. If you take into consideration what's going to matter outdoors, you know, for the trials, 2012 trials and on into London. Wow.
Absolutely. And that's why that race, I'll never forget it. It was the turning point of coming back from 3 years of loss, 3 years of failure. It lit the fire in me to say, you have to do something. You were unaware. You thought you were good. You thought training was great. You thought you got a new weight coach. You thought everything was great. And you didn't realize that your head is messed up.
Right.
And this game is 90% mental.
Yeah. And there's still some old, there's some old demons, you know, old ghosts that need to be sort of identified and reworked through that process that you developed, which I think was so beautiful how you were able to, because I noticed I was just, I was watching your 400 meter final. I remember it like it was yesterday in the 2012. I wasn't at the games that year, but I watched it here where we live out here in Pennsylvania. And you got that mantra right there. I think you're reciting Philippians from 4:11-13. I think you're going through that. It's just so beautiful. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And you're saying that right on the line. You can see your lips moving. It's so beautiful. And if you watch the race, I mean, you almost won that race. I mean, you always were like, at 350 meters, you are clearly in the lead. I mean, it's just a beautiful run. It's a beautiful run. It's just incredible to see, you know, coming from 2008, the career is, she says, okay, everybody's saying, hang it up. This is it. You had a great career, but that's it. And then you just rebuilt yourself mentally, spiritually, physically, all these things, emotionally, coming together. And it all manifests from, you know, the bronze, which, as you said very beautifully, is just another shade of gold, which I believe 100%. Yes. And then the gold medal in the 4x4, which you led off against the former Olympic champion from Great Britain, which I just saw. And, you know, 49.4. I mean, a beautiful lead off leg. So, and that's the dream team. That was, you know,
that was the dream.
Handed off to Alison Felix. I mean, come on. It was amazing. Sonia the anchor. I mean,
and Francina McCory.
Yeah. And all y'all. I mean, the slowest, the slowest, right?
Yeah, the slowest of 49. Right?
I mean, 49.4. Come on. Exactly. I mean, that 3:16.88. I mean, I mean, that was just historically just incredible. If we look at your journey, I mean, as a pastry chef now, valedictorian from the Atlanta Institute, I mean, amazing. What's most important to you now, and what does the road ahead look like, and what's next?
You know, man, Phil, that's a wonderful question, and I think it's a necessary question for me to answer, because I think I need to hear the answer.
Okay, good.
Out loud, you know.
Good. Yes.
The goal right now is to try to again live in the purpose of my gifts.
Yes. Yes.
And one thing that I miss about track and field, people always ask me, you know, do you miss running? Do you miss track and field? And you know, earlier I told you I physically made sure I didn't right. have that desire.
Right.
I made sure I ran every inch of gas out of me.
Wow.
But it's not, that's not what I miss the most about running. What I realize is that, and what I've come to realize is that, and I actually realized it many years ago, which I think was a beautiful part of connecting with loving the sport, that as I use my gift, I'm in closer connection with God.
That's right. That's right.
And that is one of the most, I would say it's the most missed aspect of not running track anymore. Being out on the track, no matter how hot, no matter how cold, no matter what the conditions, you know, you when you're out there and when you're using your gift.
Yeah.
I don't know how everybody else functions, but I feel closer to God. I feel I feel his presence. I feel his essence everywhere.
Like an electricity, and like it just fills you up. It's just like an energy.
It's there. He's real.
Coming through you and all around you. And it just feels like you're in the right moment. It's right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I feel lucky, to be honest with you. I feel lucky that I have these experiences where he feels real, you know, and there's days, many, many days, many, many years, even since I retired, where without that, as I go through day-to-day life without running as a part of my day-to-day activity, or without track and field, I should say, it's really not the running, without the sport as a part of my day-to-day life, I don't get those moments like I used to get them all the time, you know?
Yes.
And so there's these gaps, you know, there's these times where I almost have to work hard to create them. I have to go on nature hikes and, you know, like,
find these quiet right. Things. You're so used to pushing yourself and feeling that presence through the suffering that you don't get as much. But now the long hours, I imagine as a master chef, I mean, the long hours of getting up super early, another super hard profession. And I noticed, please, y'all go to Detrot 400 meters on Instagram and you will see the most amazing, beautiful pastries. I mean, one of them has a little Starbucks, I mean, super creative Starbucks cup in it. And I was like, got the hip hop behind it, like super cool music. And I'm like, I got to get to Atlanta. I got to sample this woman's mastery.
Thank you.
You know, so it's just amazing. At the Druid Hills Golf Club, right?
That's where I'm at now. I also have my own business I do from home. So if you can't get into the golf club, which you have to have a membership, if you don't want to join the Druid Hills Golf Club for $100,000 a year, you can be a member too.
I won't be in the golf club, so I'll be able to.
If you can't get there, you can go to tasteofgoldbakery.com.
Taste of Gold Bakery. My slogan is greatness.
Greatness has a taste.
We'll put all it that sure in the liner, that liner notes, because if you go in there and see that, you'll immediately, all your senses will come alive and you'll say, you know what, this is really remarkable. I need to sample this. And if we look at the slipstream, looking back at your life, Dee Dee, any parting gems of advice you'd like to leave for us here on Intrinsic Drive?
Yeah, man. I feel blessed to have gone through such a journey of so many different ups and downs. I'm glad I didn't have the straight path that had no humps or impediments along the way. Otherwise I wouldn't have anything to tell you right now.
That's right.
I would say my biggest advice to anyone is basically to let your failure be the blueprint of your success.
Beautiful.
Take everything that you have gone through, everything that you feel maybe has tried to stop you along the way. And if you've given up on your dream because you failed, because you've lost, because you've been disappointed, because you've been hurt, because you fear, because you have doubt, all of those things are simple motivators if you learn how to transform them into positive power. And what I learned to do is to take all of those things and put them under myself. Mm-hmm. I use them to climb on top of, instead of letting them get on top of me and push me down and destroy me. I use those things to push myself to the next level. And everyone has the possibility to do this. It's just a matter of getting into your own head and saying, I can, I must, I will. I can't, I must, I will.
That's right. That's just,
those words have been, I'm getting emotional right now because as I'm trying to tell you what has created that, you know, that mental champion in me, you know, these things are not something that stops. You can't just think that if you go through the training of mentally getting yourself strong to get through something one time that it's going to last you a lifetime.
It's not one and done. It's a constant practice. And that's what comes. That's what comes through you, is that you are just a champion of this inner discipline of allowing, you know, God's beauty and the grace to come through you in that hard work. And I love what you put forth about the container, you know, that box that you have in one of your talks that you brought forth in this graduation of 2020, was the middle of COVID, and you're speaking virtually to these students, and you're saying, look, y'all, it's not about the external box or the how it looks on the outside. This is a beat up box that holds something, and I want to show you, it doesn't look great. You know, there's blemishes. It's all scuffed up. It's been through the wars. But when I open that up, inside is gold. And that's you. That's your essence. That's your essence. And I think that you're teaching us so much, and it's just such an honor and a blessing and a privilege to be with you. And I so appreciate your time on coming to the show. And
oh, thank you, Phil. It's been an absolute honor to speak with you. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story in a way that's very transparent and, and, you know, it's be,
so real.
So real. Like to tell, those are the parts of stories that people won't know. And, you know, often when you get a chance to tell your story, it's always polite to polish some of those things out, but at some point you just got to tell your truth, you know, and let that, and as long as you're respectful, you know, let it be the, be the way. I thank you for giving me the platform to do that. And I also want to thank you for letting me have this opportunity to mention some of the great people that had a lot to do with, had everything to do with continuing to keep me functional throughout my career. I was trying to talk about the coach at Georgia, that he's at Georgia now, but he was at UCF. It's Coach Sinclair. He's the reason I was able to get back to Olympic lifting.
Fantastic.
And Brett Moldenhauer was my acupuncturist. He was the reason I was able to even really stand up and walk for a long time. It's just, you know, there's been so many people and I would love to acknowledge them all, but I just want, you know, to thank you for at least giving me an opportunity to mention some of them and highlight how awesome they had been for me throughout my entire career. Abe Kiggins was my personal trainer for many years.
Okay.
He took care of me on a day-to-day basis.
Wow. Yeah.
Everything for years. And so he was part of my career from the beginning, from Tennessee all the way to the end. All the way until I moved to UCF. So, you know, just so many people. I just want to thank you that I got a chance to mention them today.
Well, it comes through, received to share, and you're living that. You're living that. So, and so where was it be the next place that we can find out about one of your speaking engagements, Didi? Where will we find out about that?
I'm doing this wonderful speaking. I've been a motivational speaker since I retired, and it's been so awesome because it's like I get to do all of the running without physically running. I tell the stories and I get to relive it so many times.
You're so amazing at it. So amazing at it.
Thank you,
so inspirational. Yeah.
Thank you. So I've been booking since COVID. I was really busy before COVID. I was literally around the world. But COVID came and slowed everything down quite a bit, but things are really picking back up. So
great.
I have started booking more events for 2022, and I'm already booking for 2023. So
excellent. Okay.
You can go to ddtrotter.com.
ddtrotter.com, your website.
Yes, and you can submit an inquiry for your event, or
excellent.
You can actually call and we can get you set up and see if we're available for your date. I am just, you know, kind of, I would say I specialize in, motivational talks or keynotes.
Yes.
And it's really for any group, Phil, no matter the age, no matter the demographic, it does not matter. My story crosses boards.
Yes.
And it's the story of a champion. And it's not the champion that we all are so familiar with. It's the champion that every person actually has access to, just being the best version of yourself. And so that is the story that I tell. I help people understand how to win on all levels. I help people understand the journey from the bottom to the top, and I help them believe in themselves. And I have been so blessed. I think if I ever had to say what two things God gave me that, you know, just really have been natural gifts, one was running. And then two is being able to tell the story of that journey in a way that crosses all bounds.
Yeah. And you're very succinct, and you just get right to the essence of it. And I love that. It's just so,
thank you so
powerful.
Much.
It adjusts to any demographic, as you said. And so we'll definitely drop that in the liner notes of ddtrotter.com, and you'll find a place to put the inquiry and book the next event. So we'll see you soon. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. And thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you opting in, subscribing, and reviewing us, for thumbing us up and following us on socials. liking us. We like you. Drop us a note. Tell us what stories move you. For books, videos, resources, and more information, visit us at whartonhealth.com/shopwhartonhealth. And be sure to join us for the next episode of Intrinsic Drive.